Now this presentation, or the work that we're about to present, is based on, as Scott mentioned, a major EU project which was carried out between 2004 and 2008. And a large tranche of this project was on the different ways in which the public administration and policymakers make use of research in migration policy making, and it really looked at three cases. It looked at the British Home Office, it looked at the German Federal Office for Migration and Refugees, and it looked at the European Commission. And the main output from that project is this monograph with CUP, which came out 2009. Now, this research really started off with a premise, which was that there seems to be an anomaly in the relationship between the production of research related to migration policy and the take-up of that research. So basically what I think generally can be observed in this area is that there's a huge interest in research, or there has been a huge interest in research, that might be changing now. But from the 1990s onwards, there was this burgeoning of research and research funding in the area of migration studies, including migration research, which was specifically oriented to guide policy making, so applied research on migration policy. And we can see this through various developments, for example, the establishment of in-house research departments, looking at migration and refugee issues within the Home Office, within the German Federal Office, the establishment of the European Migration Network, which was a sort of network comparative research between EU countries. Various international organisations have expanded research competence. And not least, there's been quite a lot of government funding for various institutes and large projects, such as the International Metropolis Programme, the EMISCO Network of Excellence, NORFACE, and not least COMPASS itself. So there's this huge interest in research, and clearly backed up by quite substantial governmental and international organisational funding. And yet, again and again, one's confronted with this rather sceptical view that, well, there's this research out there, but it's just not taken up in policy making. So a lot of research gets commissioned, but policy seems to more or less ignore the injunctions of research, or a large chunk of this research. Now, why would this be the case? Well, typical explanations that one reads in the literature on knowledge utilisation would emphasise perhaps problems of knowledge transfer. So the idea here is that research is being produced, but it's just not produced in a usable form. So it's too abstract, or it's too generalised. It's just not the sort of stuff that policymakers can make use of. Or another variant of this notion of problems of knowledge transfer is that officials simply don't have time to sift through the huge quantities of research out there and absorb it in order to apply it in policy making. So there's a lot of research that's potentially relevant, but there's a lack of capacity within bureaucracies in particular to process and make use of that knowledge. Another typical explanation is, well, research is all good and well, but policymakers face various political constraints, problems of feasibility in putting such research into practice. Migration policy is obviously a very politicised area, so research is perhaps a little bit ivory tower. It can't really be realised in practice. Now, both of these hypotheses as to why research isn't being used seem plausible, and they probably both have some truth in them. But they don't really explain why there's a continued interest and continued resources devoted to commissioning research. So if research really is confronted with these impediments to knowledge transfer, why do policymakers and governments keep commissioning it? Or if the injunctions of research don't seem feasible, they can't be implemented in practice because of political constraints, again, why would governments continue to fund such research on a large scale? Wouldn't they just give up on those sorts of research projects and just stick to the more pragmatic considerations, not based on expert knowledge? Now, I think the answer to this conundrum is that research is playing a very important function. It is valued by policymakers, but not necessarily in the way that one might expect or in the way that researchers would like. In fact, research is playing two rather different, more symbolic functions in policy. So I reject this prevalent theory within, let's say, most kind of mainstream accounts of knowledge exchange and knowledge utilization, that research plays an instrumental or a problem-solving role. And instead, I suggest it's performing two other very crucial functions. The first of these is a substantiating function. And by this, I mean that research is invoked to underpin the particular preferences of policymakers, so sort of research as ammunition. And the second slightly different function of research is a legitimizing function. And by this, I mean that research is being used to bolster the credibility of organizations or bodies or actors engaged in policymaking. Now, they're similar but crucially different. So substantiating knowledge is knowledge which is used to lend credibility to specific types of arguments or policy preferences, whereas legitimizing knowledge is knowledge which is used to bolster the authority of particular bodies or organizations as capable of making rational decisions in the area of migration. Now, under what conditions do these alternative symbolic types of knowledge utilization occur? Well, in the book I develop a sort of theory of the conditions under which we see the three different types of knowledge. So if we start off with the substantiating function, which as we saw is where policymakers or officials use knowledge to support specific preferences or claims in the context of argumentation over policy options. When does this occur? Well, obviously there has to be contestation over the issues involved. So in other words, policymakers or officials need to be looking for resources to bolster, justify, substantiate particular arguments vis-a-vis other rival arguments. Now, not just this, it's not enough that the area is simply contested, but it must be generally acknowledged that expert knowledge is a valid tool or resource for settling disputes. And here I introduce a distinction between two different modes of settlement, technocratic modes of settlement and democratic modes of settlement. And my argument is that in certain areas, it's generally accepted that competing values or interests should be salient in adjudicating between different policy options. In other words, lay opinions about values and interests can trump injunctions of expertise or research. And those are contrasted to technocratic modes of settlement, which is areas in which it's acknowledged that expertise has authority in settling disputes over rival claims. Now, different sorts of issues can slip in and out of being a technocratic and a democratic mode of settlement. For example, we've seen in the area of labour migration policy in the UK that we had a period under New Labour during which many actors in political debate considered that this was a topic that could be settled at least partly through technocratic modes of argumentation. But arguably that phase is now over, and it's recognised now that values and interests seem to trump economic or demographic arguments about labour demand. So basically the idea is substantiating knowledge kicks in where it generally recognised in political debates that technocratic modes of settlement prevail. Now, it's more likely that that kind of technocratic mode of settlement is accepted as appropriate in certain types of policy area. And I argue that often areas of risk and areas where there are challenges of very complex steering are typically areas in which technocratic modes of settlement are deemed to be the most relevant. So areas of risk are those areas in which there's recognised to be uncertainty about the potential damages or harms caused by decisions taken now. And in areas of risk, such as obviously climate change, certain new technologies whose impacts are uncertain, and arguably in an area like migration policy, there's a lot of reliance on experts to model and project possible scenarios of what might happen if we do X, if we adopt approach X rather than Y. So in these areas of risk, technocratic modes of settlement may well be seen as appropriate. Complex steering, now that refers to policy areas in which the basic goals of policy are generally agreed on, but there are some very complex technocratic issues about how best to get there. How best do we steer economic and social systems? How do we get people to behave in the appropriate way to achieve desired ends? And in those sorts of areas, we can expect technocratic modes of settlement. And finally, perhaps this seems quite obvious, but we can expect knowledge to play a substantiating role where the policy community involved in debates on migration policy are generally well informed, and they create expectations that a kind of valid contribution to migration policy debates has to be grounded in expert knowledge, it has to be well informed, it has to keep on top of, you know, latest research on this issue. And this generates this expectation that officials, in particular, can master the evidence and can hold their head up in quite technocratic policy discussions. And arguably this has occurred in the area of migration policy in the UK since the late 1990s or early 2000s. So these are the sorts of conditions under which this substantiating function of knowledge may kick in. And I guess an obvious example of this is from around 2000 onwards in the UK, when the new Labour government started to make the case for the economic benefits of labour migration. And there are a couple of very prominent reports which contributed, research reports which contributed towards making that case, in particular the 2002 paper on the economic impact of migration, which was PIU and IPPR and Home Office, I think, collaboration. And this research report was used quite extensively in various speeches and the government white paper to justify the expansion of labour migration schemes in the UK. What about the legitimising function of knowledge? When might that prevail? Now, as I mentioned, the legitimising function refers to knowledge being used or marshalled to signal the competence or the credibility of an organisation in making sound, well-founded and rational decisions. When might an organisation think it can gain this sort of reputation through marshalling knowledge? Well, usually it kicks in where there's some kind of inter-organisational rivalry. There's some sort of competition for competence in particular policy areas, such that organisations are looking for resources which enable them to establish their mastery of that particular policy field, to establish their competence and their kind of resource base to be, let's say, the sort of key policymaker within that field. That's one condition. The second condition is that the government derives legitimacy at least partially through, let's say, symbolic types of output rather than delivery. And I should explain what I mean by this. This distinction between output and symbolic forms of legitimation is based on work by Niels Brunson, who's actually an organisational sociologist. And he distinguishes between action and political organisations. Now, action organisations are those that derive legitimacy through the observed impact of their output on their environment. In other words, they deliver services and products. Those can be observed by customers, and they're rewarded, these organisations are rewarded with support or legitimacy based on how good those outputs are. That's contrasted to political organisations, whose outputs are much more diffuse, not so tangible, perhaps very long term. And these organisations, instead of deriving legitimacy from delivery and actual observed output, derive legitimacy from much more symbolic types of actions, for example, through their rhetoric, through their formal structures. And it's really these sorts of symbolic political organisations that are much more likely to value knowledge as a form of legitimation These sorts of organisations are really keen to demonstrate their competence in a particular field, and they consider that they can do that, can demonstrate their competence through kind of symbolic use of knowledge to lend credibility to their organisation, i.e. they can point to a research department within the organisation to show that they're, you know, rational, sound, well-informed, and so on. Again, in the case of the legitimising function of knowledge, we also have to assume that there's a policy community that thinks that research competence is relevant to good policy. In other words, accepts that, you know, evidence-based policy is a desirable type of policy making in the relevant field. Finally, what about the instrumental function? Well, I was a bit dismissive about this at the outset, but clearly there are conditions under which research does play a kind of problem-solving role, and by that I mean situations in which research is actually marshaled to adjust substantive output, to change policy in order to adjust output. Now, when might that occur? Well, I made this distinction before between political organisations that derive legitimacy through symbolic rhetoric and formal structures, and organisations that derive legitimacy through delivery or output. Now, in the case of the instrumental function of knowledge, we can assume that organisations will use knowledge in this instrumental fashion where they're judged by their output. So they know that they're going to derive legitimacy or lose legitimacy through the actual delivery of services or products or policy outcomes. So they really want to get the outcomes right. They have to, because the electorate's going to observe what they do and what the impacts of those actions are, and they're going to be rewarded or penalised accordingly. So they need to find resources to adjust policy to make sure it achieves the right impacts. That sounds obvious, but a lot of organisations are highly symbolic and they're not really that bothered about this kind of output. Not just that, but they have to recognise that an appropriate way of adjusting output is through drawing on knowledge. So in other words, they can't just adjust output in the right way through thinking about public opinion and interests of users of their services, for example. Expert knowledge is a key resource to adjusting output in the desired way. And moreover, it's not always self-evident that research will be the right type of knowledge to underpin these adjustments. In many cases, practitioner knowledge will suffice, or perhaps bureaucratic data will be sufficient to adjust policy in the right way. So for this instrumental function to kick in, it has to be considered that research is the most appropriate resource for making the relevant adjustments. Now, you know, as you can see, these conditions are quite difficult to meet. So for that reason, I hypothesise that genuine problem-solving or instrumental knowledge use is going to be highly circumscribed. It's not going to occur very often. So I summarise the hypotheses there. I think we can quickly move on to the indicators. Now, how would one know if these three different types of knowledge use were occurring? And what kind of indicators would suggest that we can say with certainty that, you know, knowledge is being used in this instrumental, substantiating, or legitimising fashion? Well, I think one of the first telling indicators along the top row, number one, is how interested are policymakers in the research which they're commissioning? What kind of exchange is there between decision makers and those conducting the research? Well, in the case of instrumental knowledge, we'd expect quite intensive exchange between decision makers at a fairly senior level and the research unit, the researchers conducting the research within the organisation. Why? Because they want to use this knowledge to adjust output. So it really makes a big difference. It matters very significantly to them what the goals of the project are, what methodology is being used, what kind of research design, what sort of you know, how robust the research is and whether it's going to produce the right findings to adjust policy output. In the case of legitimising knowledge, we wouldn't expect there to be such a strong interest in the nitty-gritty of the projects which are being carried out. Instead, policymakers are basically interested in ticking the box and saying, look, we do research, we do good quality, sound research. So they might be quite interested in, let's say, the credentials of the researchers or the sort of authority of the individuals involved in drafting the report, but they'll be less interested in, you know, the details of research findings and robustness of methodology and so on. In the case of substantiating knowledge, i.e. knowledge to underpin specific claims, we kind of expect some limited exchange between decision makers and the research unit, but in a rather targeted way. There'll be an interest in ensuring that the research fits with the arguments that want to be made, that it produces the right kind of knowledge that will justify claims, and that it can stand up against criticism from opponents of that particular policy position. Now, similarly, the second set of indicators in the middle row there are about the agenda and about the extent to which policymakers are interested in fashioning the research agenda of the unit engaged in research. So in the case of instrumental knowledge, we'd expect the substance of the research agenda, to reflect performance targets of the organisation. So if the organisation is particularly aware that it's going to be judged on, for example, the delivery of, let's say, lower rates of asylum applications, then it will be particularly keen to commission research which delivers information that it will help it adjust policy to reduce asylum applications, if that's indeed possible. But we'll come to that later, actually. In the case of legitimising knowledge, one can expect, again, a looser fit between the substance of the research agenda as it's defined, and performance targets of the organisation, because what really matters, again, is to say, look, we have a research unit, it's doing this really amazing stuff, aren't we clever as an organisation? And in the case of substantiating knowledge, there is some interest in ensuring that the research follows the agenda which is appropriate for substantiating particular claims and areas of contention. So we'd expect the agenda to be focused on particularly thorny, contentious issues where the government of the day is interested in justifying its chosen line of policy. And the final set of indicators, and we're going to move on to the empirics quite soon for those of you who aren't so keen on the theoretical bit. The third type of indicator is about interest in publicising the research. Now, we can expect that where research is being used in this instrumental way to adjust output, there's no particular interest in publicising research and publishing findings and broadcasting to the policy community the fact that one's done this research, because research has quite a sort of internal function within the organisation of adjusting output. What matters is the delivery, what actually happens on the ground and how that's judged, rather than the policy making process and how legitimate that is. In the case of legitimising knowledge, we expect a quite strong interest in publicising research or the fact that research is being done. So, for example, if a ministry sets up a research department in order to legitimise its role in a policy area, we would expect it to be quite keen on broadcasting its research through, you know, a series of working papers, sending out reports to members of the policy community and so on. And finally, in the case of substantiating knowledge, again, we'd expect this more selective interest in publicising knowledge. Research produced by the organisation will probably tend to get publicised insofar as it underpins the particular claims, preferences of officials and policymakers in order to sort of help them win a particular argument. So those indicators basically guided my research on these three case studies of these in-house research units within these three organisations. Now, I'm going to focus on what I found in the Home Office now, for obvious reasons. Now, in 2000, A new Immigration Research and Statistics Service was set up in the Home Office. Now, that within what was then the Immigration and Naturalisation Division, which is then with BIA, which is now BA, as you probably know. Now, there had already been a RDS research data and statistics department with the Home Office, within the Home Office for some time, but this was a new initiative signalling the need to develop a wider research capacity in the area of immigration and asylum in particular. And it involved creating 12 new posts, and it was jointly funded by IND and the RDS. Now, what appeared to prompt the expansion or the sort of initiation of this new research service within IND and the Home Office, well, it was very much accompanied by this New Labour rhetoric of evidence-based policy making. Now, this is very modish from around, you know, the late 1990s. The Cabinet Office produced a white paper called Modernising Government, and it was very keen to stress that, you know, we're going to move away from policy based on dogma and ignorance towards this, you know, brave new world of policy based on what works. You know, we're going to find the evidence, and policy is going to be based on the evidence about what works. So this was very much used in the initial rhetoric about IRSS, that it was about evidence-based policy making on immigration and asylum. At the same time, as most of you will be aware, there was, in a sense, a kind of big campaign. I mean, it's probably not appropriate to call it a campaign because it wasn't probably thought out or organised in that way, but there were kind of various strands coming together within and around the government in the late 1990s, which militated in favour of a much more liberal and positive approach to labour migration. So in 2000, you had sort of New Labour really shifting its approach on labour migration and setting up a number of, expanding a number of programmes, notably the Highly Skilled Migrant Programme in 2002. And it published a white paper that same year called Secure Borders, Safe Haven, which made a very, very explicit, positive, bold case for the economic and social, but especially the economic benefits of labour migration. Now, as I mentioned before, underpinning this new approach was in particular this study carried out by the Home Office and IPPR called Migration and Economic and Social Analysis, which was liberally quoted within the white paper, for example, and within the speeches of Barbara Roach and subsequently David Blunkett and various protagonists of this approach. This wasn't the only important research report which was invoked in these debates. There was also a famous IPPR study about the net fiscal contribution of immigrants to the economy, and this famous claim that between 1999 and 2000, immigrants had made a net fiscal contribution of £2.5 billion. Again, that was very, very much, very frequently cited in government rhetoric in this area. So in light of this context, it would prima facie seem to be that one of the drivers is this evidence-based policy-making agenda, which sounds a bit like legitimising knowledge. And the second main driver seems to be this need for substantiating knowledge, this idea that, you know, we need to make a strong case for a change in policy and that that can be underpinned by research. So how did IRSS fare? Well, in the early days, as I said, it was quite a kind of buzz around it, and the new researchers were quite excited about this idea that they were going to be providing this evidence-based policy, and there was a 2001 launch conference which was called Bridging the Information Gaps, and it was all about widening our knowledge and providing evidence base for better policy making. In a sense, in the early days, the researchers had quite some scope for defining what research they worked on. So, at least in this early phase, we could say it was a kind of supply-driven research model. The 12 new researchers, they had PhDs, They had experience in the area of migration and asylum policy, and they had a real sense of where the knowledge gaps were and what kind of research should be done. And although they were obliged to define, develop research projects in collaboration with IND officials, nonetheless, they had the feeling that they had some scope for feeding ideas to officials or placing ideas in a broader context and coming up with projects that were, let's say, academically driven and intellectually credible. So in a sense, I think what this suggests about this phase of IRSS research was that, you know, there was this evidence-based policy-making drive, which was pretty much a top-down process. Cabinet Office was quite keen on injecting money and encouraging different departments within the administration to invest in providing this evidence base through in-house research units, kind of top-down initiative. But at the same time, there was this interest in broadening the research base in order to bolster Labour's particular policy preferences in the area of labour migration in particular. Now, this kind of initial heyday of wonderful new research department within IND didn't last terribly long, and already around 2002-2003 there were kind of increasing internal criticisms within the organisation about what this research department was doing, and one of the researchers said to me, it felt like, you know, people within the organisation were saying, we're just off on a frolic, we're just these researchers who are just kind of having a bit of fun and doing research that we're interested in doing, and it's not adding to IND work. And here we should point out that IND is, let's say, a very sort of practitioner-oriented part of the Home Office. There is a policy wing which is based in central London, but in Croydon, I guess there's a sense, at least amongst the researchers based there, that there's a sort of sense of practitioner wisdom and people actually working on the ground and people sort of doing the sort of working at the coalface of asylum policy and immigration control and so on, have this organisational wisdom about migration and about asylum, and in a sense they find the research a bit rather abstract, perhaps rather polemically or perhaps rather biased towards a more liberal agenda, and don't necessarily see it as very legitimate or reliable or useful. So there was a sense that this research department was wasting resources. IND was actually funding 50% of the research department, while RDS was funding the other 50%. And in some instances, there were actual debacles over the credibility of particular research findings. For example, there was a research report, I think it was in 2002, which analysed the determinants of choice of asylum country by asylum seekers. And I can't remember off the top of my head, it was Swansea researchers. And this report suggested that, contrary to Home Office wisdom, the severity of domestic policy on asylum didn't make an awful lot of difference to asylum seekers' choice of country, that far more important as determinants were the existence of social networks, a history of colonial ties or bilateral ties between country of origin and country of asylum, and factors such as these that weren't sort of open to leverage by government policy. And these findings weren't particularly favoured within the Home Office, which felt that it just ran against all the sort of received organisational wisdom of practitioners. So it was, you know, questioned whether the findings could be very robust. So I guess what this really points to is, you know, there may have been this top-down perception of the value of evidence-based policy and the notion that, you know, it will lend credibility and authority and help demonstrate the rationality of decision-making if we have a research department which produces these wonderful reports. But that wasn't really widely shared view amongst most officials within the Home Office. So there wasn't really much of an appreciation of the legitimising function of knowledge. There was much more a concern that this research was rather ethereal and not really contributing towards the delivery output-oriented goals of the organisation. So what happened in 2004, the structure of IRSS was changed and it shifted to a so-called embedded structure, which was not atypical for other parts of RDS within the Home Office. The basic change was that the researchers were seen as clients to the customers, who were the officials, and there were quite rigorous new procedures for approving and monitoring research projects produced by IRSS. So they had to be rigorously internally reviewed, and it had to be absolutely a watertight case made that these projects were meeting an identified need. So basically, officials within the organisation had to say, yes, there's an absolute clear present need for this research, and the research is sort of closely targeted towards providing that the knowledge required. And there's Gary Raw, who I don't know whether he's still head, but he was head of IRSS at the time, told me that resource is not so magnanimously given that we can afford to do a pile of research and hope some of it is useful, which was obviously the idea of what had been going on in the previous pre-embedded era. And I guess critics of this new embedded structure complained that they weren't really doing research anymore. They were providing what they termed management information. Having said that, it was much more instrumental. So in a sense that it lost its academic credibility, but arguably precisely because it was responding to very focused and targeted identified organisational needs, it had become that much more instrumental. Now, paradoxically, a few years after the shift to the embedded structure, the recommendation was that it return back to a much more academically grounded, forward-thinking, research-based competence. And the Office of Science and Innovation did an evaluation of RDS, including IRSS, and recommended a return to horizon scanning. So it said, while there are clear benefits to having embedded scientists, a weakness of this approach is the tendency to miss out on longer-term strategic research needs. So because they were just listening to officials who were saying, today I have this urgent problem, can you do some research on that, it lacked this bigger picture and was unable to fill these more general gaps in research and knowledge that would make it more forward-looking. So it kind of suggests this rather cyclical trend. Interestingly, I found very similar tendencies within the migration unit set up within the German Federal Office for Migration and Refugees. Now, I won't go into this case much, but they set up a research department at a similar time. And again, it was, I'd say, largely a legitimizing function, because there was a lot of competition in the field of migration policy in Germany between organizations to have preeminence in policymaking in that field. And there'd been a lot of discussion of the usefulness of research in migration policymaking in the context of the Zusmut Commission, for example. So there's a growing expectation that a competent organisation in the sphere of migration needs to have research capacity. And the Federal Office was given this research capacity really as a way of signalling its authority, competence in this area. And a similar thing happened, which was that researchers turned up, started to do their kind of big academically grounded projects and so on, and officials within the organisation started saying, well, what are these guys doing? That they're not really contributing, they're getting these salaries, they're going off and doing this, frankly, quite irrelevant research. Now, interestingly, in the German case, and I'm going to say something about this in a second, the fact that the German bureaucracy has a much more entrenched tradition of valuing research and valuing the legitimising function of knowledge meant that actually this research department didn't get relegated to being a kind of a wing of operational activities. So it didn't get kind of embedded in the way that research in the Home Office did. Researchers were by and large able to retain their relative independence and even to secure terms which meant they were able to publish their work in academic outlets and get some sort of esteem and renommé while performing this sort of research function within the organisation. I think that's quite an interesting difference. Similar tension, but it's resolved in a slightly different way. So what are the implications of what I found in particular the Home Office case for this theory of the different functions of knowledge? Well, one of the interesting findings, I think, was that the value attached to research and the function that research is perceived to play varies across the organisation. So, for example, senior management might be much more concerned about the legitimising function of knowledge. So, for example, kind of top-down efforts to ensure that there's evidence-based policymaking and that this can be demonstrated through a research department. That's more typically the concern of senior management, who are more involved in looking at the kind of big picture and the sort of territorial conflicts between different organisations about who's going to have capacity in which policy field. So they've got an eye to those sorts of issues about how to bolster the authority of their organisation in a particular policy area. The political wing of the IND, I'd say, were much more interested in the substantiating function of knowledge. People working in the minister's office, for example, got obviously certain ideas of filtering down about the sort of research that would be useful for underpinning the types of arguments that the government was trying to make about, in particular, labour migration. And the operational wing, I'd say, was quite cut off from those sorts of political considerations and was much more interested in delivery and instrumental research which would achieve certain targets. And in particular, something that very much dominated these years was the target of reducing, I think, Blair's Newsnight gaffe, where he promised to halve the number of asylum seekers, which just completely reoriented the whole of IND operations, because suddenly they were going to be judged on the basis of achieving this target. Those sorts of considerations were really quite prevalent in the sort of operational side of IND, signifying an interest in instrumental research. But I think also another way in which this model is perhaps more fluid than I initially expected was in terms of shifting functions over time. So in the Home Office, for example, I argued that initially there was a legitimising and a substantiating interest in research, but over time, with the shift to the embedded structure, it looked more like an instrumental use of research. And I think one of the considerations here is that since once you set up a research department, obviously there are sunk costs. You have this personnel, you can't just get rid of them for legal, human resource reasons, but also, face saving, etc. So in a sense, I think in both Banff and the Home Office, officials were quite creative about the ways in which they could best make use of this capacity that they had. Just because there's, it turns out that there's not that much buy-in to the legitimising evidence-based research agenda on the part of most officials within the organisation doesn't mean that the research unit gets scrapped. It might mean that they find different ways of tapping into that resource in a way which they find more useful. And I think the other implication, which I think is quite interesting, is what I've just touched on already, which was this perceived or this apparent trade-off between the quality of research and the usefulness of research. So, researchers have certain ideas about what robust, credible, authoritative research looks like, and often officials working on quite specific areas of policy have a completely different idea about what type of research is useful. And again, we see this in both the Home Office and the German case. So in conclusion, I think I would sort of extrapolate out from this case study tentatively and speculate that these sorts of in-house research units within government agencies are quite often top-down when they're initially set up. They're not demand-driven. They're high-level political decisions to invest resources, often by policymakers who are keen to demonstrate the kind of legitimacy of their department through demonstrating its research capacity. So they're often initially at least about legitimation rather than output. Now, of course, whether they stay like that is a difficult question because, you know, tensions arise within organisations which imply the need for some sort of shift in the activities of researchers, as we've seen. And again, this tension between academic quality and the sort of usefulness or relevance of research. And I said before that I felt that tension did exist in both the Home Office and in the Federal Office for Migration and Refugees, the BAMF. But it was resolved in slightly different ways, and I would trace this back to sort of historical arguments about the role of the state and bureaucracies and how these are legitimised within the German and the UK political system. And in particular, I would argue that the Home Office isn't particularly reliant on its knowledge base as a source of legitimacy. It's, in a sense, it relies on far more populist forms of argumentation to legitimise most of its decisions. Whereas in the case of the BAMF, I'd say there is still a legacy in Germany, an influential legacy of this expectation that research should be rational and grounded and underpinned by sufficient research. Now, whether or not that research actually gets used in policy making is a completely different question, and I have strong reasons to doubt that there is an awful lot of take-up of research within the BAMF. Nonetheless, there is a sort of abstract recognition of the legitimising value of having a research department, and that keeps it in place. In fact, I mean, visiting the BAMF, I almost had this impression that the researchers, they were kind of like a zoo in this organisation. There was a strange species of people who did research, and nobody quite understood what they were doing or why or what the usefulness was, but they kind of thought, oh, we do need to have these people here. That they're really good for our organisation because we can say we have this research department. So it was really quite an odd sort of situation. And I guess what might be interesting to discuss now, and I know this seminar series is about media and public opinion, I haven't touched on those that much, but is, you know, what's changing now in the current situation? And a couple of years ago there seemed to be this shift back away from a technocratic mode of settlement in labour migration debates towards a more value and interest-based way of thinking about policy. And this is definitely reflected in and perhaps caused to a large extent by mass media coverage. So, you know, whereas in the early 2000s, I think you can safely say that the media by and large bought into the technocratic research-based argument for the economic benefits of migration, it wasn't always convinced that those trumped the social or cultural downside of migration, but there was largely an acceptance of the economic benefits of migration. And we've seen this shift now to a much more value-laden debate about migration, where I would say research is just not seen as legitimate or credible as a resource for underpinning policy preferences. And if anything, it's gone a little bit more the way of German debates in the early 2000s, where Schröder was and Schily were arguing for the green card and trying to invoke economic arguments, but were basically slammed down very quickly by populist party politics and by the mass media and retreated based on the sort of concern that these arguments looked too rarefied and elitist. And I think this has certainly happened here. So, I mean, I guess an interesting question is, what were the conditions that led to that shift? Was it really a kind of welling up of public concerns about migration based on a real impact on welfare? Or was it something that went on in the media and within political elites? I think these are really interesting questions. But I think what's clear is that it seems, at least for the foreseeable future, notwithstanding certain recent successful funding initiatives, that the interest and the role of research in migration policy just isn't what, or won't be what it was under the Labour government for quite a while.
Thanks, Christina.